started here. Let me pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your care for us. We thank you for the fact that you are building your church, and you've been doing that ever since you were on this earth with us. We thank you for the people who have gone before us. Help us to understand their trials and their success. Help us to learn from them. In Jesus' name, amen. Before we start, I want to make a little bit of a preliminary statement about what we're going to do today. The last three lessons, which were on the fall of Jerusalem, the Creed of Nicaea, and last week on Chalcedon, were about big events that did a relatively quick turn in the way things went. And today we're talking about something which was not like that at all. The monastic movement, something that took place over 1,000 years, and it made a gradual shift, and for a lot of people it was imperceptible, you might think, but it made a big difference in where we are today. Now, I never realized that before. However, when I first read this book more than 30 years ago now, the opening statement on that on the chapter on Benedict's Rule says, "The rise of monasticism was, after Christ's commission to his disciples, the most important and in many ways the most beneficial institutional event in the history of Christianity." I thought, that sounds kind of shocking. More significant than the Reformation? That's hard to believe if you're a Protestant. But, in fact, I think as you see, we'll see today, this is true. Even though we Protestants don't connect with monasticism very well, and I think there's reasons why that is the case, but nevertheless, without that, we would be in big trouble today. I want to talk about a couple terms to begin with here. First of all, what is monasticism? Basically, it's where people come together to live away from the world, to devote themselves to prayer, and in this case, and especially in the early days, often for an ascetic life, which means you forego all the comforts of the modern world, which in those days, 2,000 years ago, there weren't too many. And you generally devote your life to prayer to God, and you also, the monastic orders required you to give a vow of obedience to your superior, and also of poverty. So you're not going to go and acquire a bunch of wealth. Now, that didn't always happen, but that was the vow. And an ascetic person is somebody who gets rid of all these things and doesn't let them interfere with their life. We don't really connect with that very much today because we've got so much stuff, it doesn't even hardly register. But they had very little, and they did do that. So there's three different groups here. This is as far as groups, people coming together. A monastery is the typical place, and a convent's the same thing except for women. And a friary is like a monastery, except the people who live there actually go out to the world. The people in the monastery stay inside. The people in the friary go outside. So they're actually helping people, as we would say, as a deacon would do today. And that, as I think, that's an improvement over simply going in and hiding from the world. So there were several types, and let's just say in the Catholic world, which was the West, people did not... people divided into different orders, but in the East they didn't do that.
There's
the type. That's kind of misleading. So there's four types here. These were pretty much in the East and the West to some extent, but not always quite there. A cenobitic is basically a monastery where there's a bunch of men together in one place. An anchorite is a person who basically lives in their cell, but the cell could be right next to the church. So they're not really out in the woods somewhere, or the desert, as it was, but they're right there in the community, but they're not talking to people. They're kind of isolated. Hermetic is somebody who is basically out, way away from everybody else, doesn't want any contact with anybody. Even like the word hermit today is what that means. And the last category here, skeet, that refers to somebody who's basically in both worlds. So during the week, they're isolated. On Saturday and Sunday, they're with people. So they come to church, for example. So those are the four types of monastic people that we encounter. Now, first time we went to Ethiopia, I discovered that all monks were not Orthodox or Catholic. In fact, we met a German nun. I thought, whoa. So in the Lutheran church and in some other, like the Anglican churches, those people have set up monastic orders to some extent. Not real common. I don't know of any in... Well, actually, there are a few in this country. There's a place in Kentucky. What's it called? My company, I forgot about putting that in there. But it's not totally foreign here, but it's kind of foreign. Any questions about any of those things? So why did people do this? Well, sometimes they left town because of persecution. And sometimes the persecution could be fairly severe. Sometimes they left because the state and the church were in good fellowship, you might say. So they could do that without actually being persecuted, but they did it because things were too cozy. So if the church is too cozy with the state, maybe that's not a good thing. In fact, that book I mentioned at the beginning by Rodney Stark has a lot of insight into how we have perceived our history, in that we don't often recognize that when Constantine made Christianity legal, it actually wasn't a good thing in all respects. Certainly we don't want persecution, but you know, with no persecution, a lot of the people became Christians because it was politically advantageous. They got promoted. And so Constantine's court, there were Christians there. And it continued on that way. And so pretty soon the idea of Jesus calling us to be real disciples didn't really make any difference in how those people lived. Also in the monastic area, there was an opportunity for a stable community where things weren't, you know, happening to you from outside, and you could actually focus on what you wanted to do. As far as what you're really doing as a monk, you're able to study the scriptures to some extent. Of course, they didn't have Bibles like we do today. But it was an opportunity to really understand what it means to be a believer in a spiritual sense. Not just something you say, but something you actually do in your heart, and all your effort is involved in leading that kind of life. Now, there's problems with all of these things, but we won't get into those right away. I want to begin with how we ended up with this kind of life. And the early monks looked back to people like Elijah and John the Baptist. They went off by themselves, didn't they? They did. And these people thought, well, that was a good thing. Look at them. What did Jesus say about John the Baptist? Like the greatest ever. The scenes at the time of Jesus were like that as well. And the early monks were not part of any kind of organization or any kind of movement. There were people that were self-motivated. They just did this on their own. And they did it from all sorts of different backgrounds. The most famous of the early one is Anthony of Egypt. He's well known because Athanasius wrote a biography of him. Whether or not everything in there is actually historically true, it's hard to say because there's nothing else to go on. But nevertheless, Athanasius was an honest man, so he probably he went out and met him, so he probably knew some things about what happened. But this man was motivated by hearing these two passages when he was at church. where Jesus says, if you would be perfect, go, sell what you possess, and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. And also, Matthew 6:34 from the Sermon on the Mount, don't worry about tomorrow. God will take care of you. So Anthony got rid of all of his stuff and moved out to the desert. Now, he wasn't the first, but he's the most recognized one of all the people who lived at that time. I will say that Anthony was born to a very well-off Christian family, so he had an understanding of the gospel, but he realized from the sermons in church that he probably wasn't living as Jesus said to live. And so that's what he did. He might have been illiterate, well, nobody knows, but most of these men out there in the desert took nothing to read. I mean, there was nothing out there except they had clothes on their back and some means of getting some food. But even that was pretty meager for most of it. When he went, he had a younger sister who he was taking care of because his parents had died, and he sent her to live with some other single woman and basically abandoned all his earthly responsibilities. People came to him, even though he was trying to hide out there. They came to him and asked for advice on what he was doing, why he was doing it. And there's accounts of in Athanasius' book of him having a spiritual warfare with demons. And there's a lot of particulars of what happened there that, again, we don't seem to identify with. He didn't eat very well. He had a very meager diet, sometimes only eating once a day. But he seemed to be content because he stayed out there. Another man about the same time, named Paul of Thebes. Thebes is Upper Egypt, you know, south, Upper Egypt. His story is a little bit more, or a little bit less believable, because part of it says a raven brought him half a loaf of bread every day till he died when he was 113. Well, that may be true, I don't know, but he did go out there. He was a real person. And Anthony heard about him in a dream and went to visit him, according to that, his biography, which was written by Jerome, who we'll talk about a little bit later. Another man, and also in Egypt, he first went to a normal communal monastery. And he also was the first person to write down some rules for how monks should behave. His aren't the famous ones because they didn't get propagated all over, but he nevertheless appears to be the first one that did it. And he helped establish 8 other monasteries. Augustine, who is probably the most influential person in this whole period of time, started out after his conversion in Milan to lead a monastic life. He started a monastery in his hometown down in North Africa. There's a lot we could say about him, but I'll save a little bit of it for later because there's not really time to cover a lot of his life. But anyway, one thing to say about him is Augustine was, actually, you should all read his Confessions. If you haven't read those, that's a very good book to read. It talks about how he came to faith and all his problems. But I will say that he was a teacher of rhetoric in Milan as a young man, and he went to hear Ambrose preach because he heard that Ambrose was a good preacher. He just went to hear him speak because he thought, I want to see how well he does speak. But in the process of doing that, he heard the gospel and became a Christian. This man was famous because he supposedly lived on top of a pillar his whole life. That's a drawing of him there. And there's a pillar out in the middle of nowhere, and you can see those two men standing beside it. I don't know if that was his or not, but he was on a short pillar for a while, and then he actually decided it was too close to the ground, so he got a taller one. It was about 50 feet high. He spent his whole life up there. I'm not sure how he got his food, but he must have come down to get his food somewhere or other. Here is a monastery in Egypt, which if you go to Mount Sinai today, that's the jumping off point. You walk from there. And that's not what they call Mount Sinai, but that's kind of what it looks like. It's a place where you know if the Israelites had left Egypt in January, they wouldn't have stayed out there very long because it's cold. And when we went up there, it was sleeting. And it wasn't just sleeting when it was 35. The little bit of water on the ground was ice. So it was a little bit treacherous actually walking without falling. And here is the Debrodamo Monastery in Ethiopia, which Ethiopian monks probably live a lot like they did 1,000 years ago. They haven't had much contact with the real world, but you can see them. And in fact, this is a picture here of how to get up to that monastery. You've got to climb up this rope. My daughter took a picture of me going up there, but I can't find it right now, so you can just pretend that was me. But anyway, when I got to the top, there was I wandered around for a while trying to find someone to show me around, and finally one of these monks came out. He couldn't speak any English. He just took me around and showed me different places. And one place he did show me was like a sort of a cave in the side of the hill there, and he basically gave me the impression that that's where he was going to be buried when he dies. I don't know. Yes.
Do you have a theory as to why the monastic movement took effect so prominently in Egypt?
I don't. But it wasn't just in Egypt. It was in the Eastern Church as well, over up in, out of Constantinople. I think the interesting thing is that a bunch of these men, it appears like they all made independent decisions to go out there and live, and I think the only thing I think is that they were somehow convicted that they weren't living a very spiritual life, but I don't know. Yeah, it's. I don't think they knew anything about you, so I don't think we can blame you.
I mean, I'm thinking, is it that the church had a different emphasis that led to that, or I mean, in Egypt, the desert is so prominent away from the Nile Valley, so it just makes sense that you can just go a few miles and you're in the middle of nowhere.
Right. But they did it up in Turkey too, like in Cappadocia. There's a lot of places carved out of the hillside there, where like there's sandstone or something like that. And I've been to some of those, so I don't know.
Dan?
Yes.
I've kind of studied some of this. One of the things that kind of became evident is that monasticism was responding to the church being legitimized and becoming a state religion, and so there were many that felt that the pietism was no longer prevalent in the churches, and so it was kind of a response to wanting to what they felt would be a more real expression of Christianity in response to what many perceived was changing in the churches themselves because everyone was a Christian.
I think that's true, especially a little bit later. I'm not sure how true that was in the early days. I have no idea because we don't know as much about the church in those days. But as you know, the church has had good and bad all through history. So it's hard to say. But I think a lot of them just took these verses seriously. You know, if you're my disciple, you won't do all this stuff everyone else is doing. You will separate yourself, etc. Now, the monastic movement really took off as organizing monasteries with Benedict, who you can see lived in Italy. And he was from a well-off family. He was sent to Rome for his education. But by that time, what you're alluding to here was the case. He found the church was corrupt, and there was nothing about it that he thought was good. And so he, based on that, decided to start as a monk. He went out by himself for 3 years. A bunch of other people joined him. He didn't really want that, but they did. And finally decided maybe we should form a monastery. And he began doing that. They were doing things that, like, read the Gospels. What did Jesus do? He fed the poor, healed the sick. He was preaching. And so that's the model that they're adopting for their lives. Benedict came up with some rules, though. You can't just join this monastery unless you're going to really be committed. And here's a summary of these rules. You can't have any personal possessions. You must search for spiritual perfection. You have to spend a good part of the day in work. You've got to spend a good part of the day in prayer. We ought to serve others. And remember that even though we're obeying some man called the abbot, we're really, he's just Christ's delegate. We're really obeying Christ through him. And we just separate ourselves from the world. So we're not going to be corrupted by television and the internet and that kind of stuff. It's just going to be God and me. To join one of Benedict's monasteries, you had to go on probation for a year. And when the abbot died or left, they would elect another one from among their group. And this passage from Psalm 119 is how they decide to organize their schedule for the day. Seven times a day I praise you for your righteous rules. You might know that Muslims pray five times a day. Well, they're beat by, here's their seven. And so they're roughly, the day was organized into these different categories. You can see this adds up to be quite a few hours. There's no time in there to prayer, to sleep, but that wasn't quite true. They did sleep some. But they do spend a good bit of time basically in prayer and in singing psalms. They went through a regime where in the course of a week, they would say every psalm by recitation at least once, some more than once. So by the time they were ready to retire, they knew the psalms very well, much better than we do. But they also had to work, and that was part of the schedule. So here's what a schedule looked like for a Benedictine monk in England in the 14th century. Now, this is hundreds of years, almost 1,000 years after Benedict. So this is what they're following there. And if you count on this schedule, you might not see that they have seven times to pray. But in fact, they didn't just pray seven times, because this says, I need to pray in the middle of the night. And that's what that midnight prayer is about. So now they're praying eight times a day. The Catholics came up with five monastic orders. Actually, the Benedictines were never officially approved as an order. They grew up before that, but they were certainly accepted and authorized. The other three were basically commissioned by the Pope. Now, you may think about the Jesuits as an order, but the Jesuits were not a monastic order. The Jesuits were organized after the Reformation and basically were more militant than what we consider to be good Christian behavior for what they did to persecute a lot of Protestants. Nevertheless, we'll talk about those a little bit in as we go along, these four groups. I'm going to talk about the monastic orders in terms of what benefit they brought to us. This is sort of answering the question of how it could be the most important institutional event since Jesus commissioned the disciples. First of all, in missions. You probably know about Patrick, because we have St. Patrick's Day today, even in the U.S. He was basically somehow captured and taken to Ireland and made a slave for 6 years. And after he escaped, he went back to England. The story seems to sound like he became a Christian when he was a slave. It's kind of hard to really say. The details are not real clear. But he came back to England and then went back to Ireland as a missionary. And if you read this book here, How the Irish Saved Civilization, it talks a little bit about not just Patrick, but a lot of other things, which they show how Ireland has been a source of Western cultural progress for a long, long time. Columba was a missionary from Ireland to Scotland. Here is a picture of a church. The roof's kind of missing, but that's one of his churches that was founded. And he did a lot of things besides being a missionary. He also wrote hymns, and he copied a lot of material, which is what a lot of these men did, was they copied material, Bibles, other books, prayers, all kinds of things, and kept them safe from deterioration. Augustine of Canterbury was sent by Pope Gregory around 596 to Britain, and he was a missionary to England, but he also helped convert the king, Ethelbert, to become a Christian. And that king, because of his conversion, gave land for monasteries. He allowed missionaries to preach, and Augustine became the first Archbishop of Canterbury. And he'd come from a monastery in Rome before this. Keep this man straight from Augustine of Hippo, who lived earlier, but this man went to England. Into England. Boniface is called the apostle to Germany, and he's a little bit later. He also started out as a Benedictine monk. Of course, during this first period of time, the Franciscans and the Dominicans and the Augustinians, they didn't become orders until like the year 1200 or so, something like that. So all these early monks are part of a Benedictine system, unless they're from the East or unless they're hermits. And we'll talk a lot about the Frankish Church in a little bit here, but that went through, like every other part of the Christian world, went through a period of corruption and decay, and so he helped reform that when he was in Germany. Part of the problem was people's moral standards were not scriptural. They were basically lax. They were basically nominal Christians. They weren't really true believers. And there were things involved that happened in many other places as well. For example, mixing up the Christian faith with the pagan religion around. And so there was a lot of problems that he had to deal with. These were two brothers. They were from Greece, and they became monks on the eastern side. And they developed the Cyrillic alphabet, and they translated the Bible into Cyrillic. And Cyrillic is a script that is used, maybe derivatives of it, I should say, for a lot of people in the Slavic world, Russia, all those kind of Eastern languages came out of this movement of these guys. Here's what the script looks like. This is a translation, it's a translation of the Lord's Prayer. So anybody who's from that part of the world, can you read this? But they did this, and then, as actually a lot of Wycliffe missionaries do, if the language is only oral, someone's got to make it written. That's what these guys did. Raymond Lull was the first missionary to Islam. He came from a well-off family. In his upbringing, he was actually living, as he would probably say, a reprobate life. But all of a sudden, he was confronted with the fact that he wasn't living as a Christian should. He heard about Francis of Assisi, who, as you know, also came from a well-off family, and then got rid of everything and went off and started a monastery. That's why he's called here a Franciscan monk. He's a little bit later than Francis. But he decided he was going to go convert the Muslims. Now, his father was very upset with him, and he had to basically almost cut himself off from his family in order to do this. He went off and started, first of all, he studied Arabic himself at this place in Miramar. He also started a language school to help other people learn to speak Arabic so they could go join him in Egypt. And he made several trips to Tunis. Actually, I don't know if he ever went to Egypt. I think he did, but I'm not sure. But anyway, one way he learned Arabic was he bought an Arab slave and made him his language teacher. And if you're on Paul Lim's mailing list, you know he's got the word Raymond Lull in there. Those are some mission stories of the monastic movement, but there are other areas where these monks did not focus so much on missions as their primary concern, but on some other things. And one of these men introduced some interesting things into Western culture. Like, for example, he helped introduce decimals into European thinking. The whole process of cultural change is sometimes not obvious to us, probably not obvious to most people at any given time, but things did change a lot because of the ability to use decimals in calculations. He also invented something called the hydraulic organ. So it was a pipe organ that somehow was powered by water. I don't know how it worked. He improved the abacus, which was used for calculations, which came from China. So he did some things like that, but he was also a monk. So he did have these spiritual goals in mind as well. Later he became Pope Sylvester II. Roger Bacon was a student of philosophy and science and theology, but he said, to study any of those things, we need to begin with the Bible. That's our foundation. And that's something we could certainly identify with today. People can study all kinds of things, but if they don't understand that God is a source of knowledge and truth, they're missing out. It's almost like people used to say, well, if you send your kids to a Christian school, they're going to be sheltered from the truth. Actually, no. It's the public school people are sheltered from the truth because God is truth. That's where we start. And if you understand that, it opens up your eyes to lots of good things. Roger Bacon, I don't know if this happened to you when you were in school, but my science teacher said that Roger Bacon was the man who came up with the scientific method. Become aware of a situation, problem, or state of affairs, limit and define the problem, investigate the problem by reading, research, and interviews, etc. And you go through the whole process. He wasn't a scientist in the same sense that we think of a scientist. He didn't do lots of experiments. But this idea of thinking through how you come about with some kind of scientific idea was his. William of Ockham, another important man in philosophy. And he had the idea, again, not the only one, but one that was important to him, was that we can't understand theology without faith. It's not simply putting things up in your head. There's faith. And as other people have said, like Augustine, I believe in order that I may understand. Faith comes first. That's what it says in Hebrews. By faith we understand that God created the world. So that was an important idea that he had. And he was a little bit of a Protestant, you might say, because again, before the Reformation, the church didn't have nailed down a lot of things today that we associate with the Catholic Church. These were just fluid, so people had different views. For example, he didn't believe the Pope was infallible. He believed their church and state should be separate, not together, which is what the Catholic Church wanted and had. So he was a little bit like us in terms of some of these things. I don't know how I thought about sanctification and justification, but nevertheless. Jonathan Scotus ended up teaching in several universities, came out of the monastic movement as a Franciscan friar. He wrote over 50 books, and today him and his predecessor, Occam, are studied in philosophy in universities. The most important of these, I think, though, are the category of serving the church. And in that respect, there are a lot of these. I'm only going to have a few, but I hope the few I have will convince you of the truth of the statement we began with about the influence of the monastic movement on the Christian faith. We mentioned these three men last time. They were all involved in firming up the Nicene Creed at the Council of Constantinople in 381, even though Basil died just before it happened. But all three of these men did not want to be bishops. They did not want to be leaders in the church. They wanted to be out there in the monastery. And through various arrangements and circumstances, they finally were convinced that that was what God wanted them to do. It was usually pressure from somebody else, but they ended up serving in this way and made a huge difference in what happened at that council. I often think about that when I think about, what does God want me to do? And you know, sometimes what God wants me to do is not what I want to do. And these men, certainly, that was certainly the case for them. Augustine of Hippo, we could spend the whole semester talking about him. But just want to mention three things about him that were significant. He was, as a young man, attracted to the religion of Manichaeism because it was a Gnostic idea that basically said, like a lot of Greeks said, that the soul is good, the body is evil. So, to one extent, it doesn't really matter what you do with your body as long as you've got a pure attitude. It's your heart that matters. And, of course, that allows you to live an immoral life still thinking you're righteous, which is what a lot of people would like to do, right? I mean, why do you have to get involved with greed and all the other kind of bad things? If that's just part of, you know, stealing is just part of my body doing it, I don't really want to steal. My body made me do it. But he grew up this way. He was converted, as I mentioned, in Milan. And then after his conversion, he came back and realized he had been bringing a lot of people into this faith. And so he began to preach and teach against it, to warn people that that is false. He was also involved in the Donatist controversy, which happened after one of the Roman persecutions with the Emperor Decius. And Decius made Christians, and often also church leaders especially, make a sacrifice to the emperor or burn the Bibles or other things like that on pain of death. And a lot of people, they decided they didn't want to die, so they did it. Some of them bought a certificate saying they'd made the sacrifice when they didn't really do it. Some of them did burn their scriptures. Some bishops burned their scriptures. And Bishop Donatus in North Africa said, those people, we're not going to blood them back into the church unless they go through a really big time of penance. And the church is made up of holy people, not people that are going to compromise when things get hot. Well, basically this man divided the church because some people didn't think we should be so harsh. I mean, after all, is doing what they did the unforgivable sin? No. Jesus can forgive us of all kinds of things. So this dispute took place, and this is 100 years before, well, not quite 100, but he wasn't alive when Augustine was alive. This is like in the early 4th century, and Augustine's like the late 4th century. But Augustine said, well, look, we can't read everybody's heart. The church actually consists of people who are true believers and people who are not. He called the true believers the invisible church, and the people who come but are hypocrites, the visible church. At the end of the age, God knows who they are. God will take care of it. We don't need to worry about these things. Now, of course, we do need to treat compromise with what you believe seriously, but that doesn't mean we're not going to forgive anyone. Augustine also got involved with a teaching from Pelagius, who was a British monk. Pelagius was a very devout man, very moral. An example, for example, if you want to look at the idea of by your fruits you shall know them, this man was exemplary. But he didn't believe in original sin. He believed that when you're born, you're totally innocent, and you choose if you want to be a sinner or not. That's up to you. A lot of people make the wrong choice because the world influences the wrong way, but it's up to you. You can choose whatever you want. And Augustine said, that's not the gospel. That's not biblical. And argued against him, and to a great extent kept that kind of teaching out of the church. Because this guy was a Catholic monk. He was just like Arius. He was part of the church with a heresy. So those were his three big battles that he fought when he was bishop in North Africa. Any questions about any of that?
Also, remember that he didn't want to become a bishop either.
I'm sorry?
Obviously, didn't want to become a bishop either.
No, he didn't. Here's another example. Yep, you're exactly right. A lot of these people in this whole story did not want to do any kind of leadership role, but they were imposed upon by circumstances and other things.
Do you want to speak a little bit about the connection between St. Augustine and the Reformation, Martin Luther?
I'm going to get to that in a little bit. Yeah, that's significant. Jerome is a man who translated the Bible into Latin. And as you know, at the time of Jesus, the Greek language was still there, even though the Romans, the Latin speakers, had taken over culturally, but they didn't get rid of that language. And in fact, it stayed with the Eastern Orthodox Church for more than 1,000 years. And so in the West, though, people lost use of it. And so he translated the Bible into Latin, so that it could be used, be read by ordinary people, which is kind of interesting because, you know, later on, the Catholic Church did not want the Bible translated into the vernacular, and people like William Tyndale were killed because they were doing that. But at this time, it was acceptable. Jerome started a monastery in Bethlehem, that is Bethlehem in Israel today, and he did a lot of other works like that. He wrote commentaries on the scriptures as well. Dionysius translated many texts from Greek into Latin.
Quick question.
It was.
So the early church did have a practice of translating.
Yes. Until the Reformation, basically, I'm not sure exactly when they cut that off. The reason they cut it off was because they were concerned about heresy. And they figured if you can read the Bible for yourself, you might become a heretic. Of course, heretics have read the Bible for themselves, right? So, yeah, it is a problem. But the problem is not the translation. The problem is the person who's reading it and coming up with this false teaching. So, yeah, that was done before. I mean, Ethiopia had the Bible in their language in Ge'ez a long, long time ago. So, in other languages as well. Syriac, it was translated to. So, this man also worked on the date for the calendar, which was a controversial problem for a long time. When do we celebrate Easter? And how do we calculate that date? It's not just like on every year it's on April 1st, you know. He also came up with the idea of Anno Domini, which means in the year of our Lord. And up until recently, that's how you see things dated, A.D., B.C., before Christ, A.D., after Christ, until people decided now it's a little too Christian. So now they say C.E. for current era. They don't want to have any connection to the Christian
faith.
It's
still marked by Christ.
It's still marked by Christ, but it,
it is.
But it's just a way to sort of separate from the truth a little bit. So most people today probably don't know what CE, how it connects to AD at all. But anyway, of course, if you live in some parts of the world, like China or Ethiopia, or even in the Arab world, they've got a different calendar, and they don't follow that at all. In Ethiopia, for example, they're still on the Julian calendar. They're about 7 years behind us. So like right now, it's probably about 2019 in Ethiopia. And their New Year's Day is on September 11th, so they're a little bit confused. But Cassiodorus was involved in government. He was a man who worked for the king of the Ostrogoths, which is one of the tribes up in Europe who were problems for the Roman Empire, why it basically collapsed militarily. Those people came down and attacked them. This was one of those. After he worked for the king for a while, he retired and became a monk. That's how he ended his life. Pope Gregory is also called Pope Gregory the Great. He also did not want to become pope. He didn't want to do any of this kind of thing. He was drafted. And the time he became pope, the church was in terrible, terrible shape. It was like, why do you want to take over that job? It was in bad shape. But he finally realized he could not say no, and so he became the pope. And he's called Pope Gregory the Great. And he may be, in some people's eyes, maybe in real life, the greatest pope the church ever had. He did lots of very good things. I mentioned he sent Augustine of Canterbury to England and helped with the conversion of the English people. He worked on church reform, which was really a problem. This guy came from an upper-class family. His father was a Roman senator, and he didn't want to do this, but he did, and his background helped him do it. He found out that, for example, there are a lot of poor people around who needed help. The church had a lot of wealth. He sold church property to help feed the poor. He realized, what are we storing up this property for in this earth? The church is about helping people, not building important buildings. There were plagues and famines during that time, and so there were a lot of people who were hungry, and he helped them. He somehow associated with a Gregorian chant. But as I looked into that, it's not exactly clear what the connection is there. Some people say he organized Gregorian chant music. But other people say, well, actually, that wasn't written until after his life. So I don't know. But anyway, Gregorian chant is beautiful music, but what he has to do with it, I don't know. He did reform the liturgy in the church, though. So he was working on that to make it more biblical. The Venerable Bede was a church historian, and he is a source of a lot of information that we have in church history. He wrote commentaries and other things that are still accessible today. Anselm of Canterbury was sent over from France to serve the church in England. Does anybody know what the investiture controversy is about? That's a controversy where the king wanted to appoint the church leaders. He wanted to appoint the bishops and the Archbishop of Canterbury. And when Anselm was facing this decision, he said, no, the church is not going to have a civil authority appoint its people, its leaders. We're not going to do that. And so he was exiled, got exiled twice. The first time he came back because the king died, and he came back. But Another thing about him that was sort of interesting is when he was young, he was about 15, he wanted to join a monastery. His father said, no way, you're not going to become one of them. So he ran away. Two things he wrote, of the many that he wrote, are significant to mention right now. One of them is, basically in English, Why God Became a Man. This is about the atonement. Why did God become a man? Why did Jesus have to die for us? Some people said, well, it was to pay off the devil. There was lots of other reasons given as well. And he said, basically, it has to do with the substitutionary death of Christ. He died in our place. This was the first well-articulated defense of the atonement view that we have today. He also wrote a book that deals with a lot of different philosophical issues. One of them, which is actually still being debated today, is whether it's sound or not. It has to do with how do we understand that God exists. I don't know if you know this, but Thomas Aquinas came up with 5 proofs for God's existence. Of course, they're not real proofs. They're arguments, but they don't usually convince anybody to become a Christian. Well, Anselm here had something called the ontological argument, which basically says something like this, and it might sound a little bit confusing, but he said, God is the greatest that anyone can imagine. If God is only something in your mind, he's not as great as if he's someone who's really existed. So therefore, he exists. That's a short version of it, which may sound circular and of no consequence, but it actually is been recognized today by first-class philosophers as a very significant argument, which we won't go into any more now. But anyway, that was Anselm. He also helped reform the church in England, which again, over time, I don't care which church you're talking about, there's need for reform. It's like one theme that has been used recently called, the phrase is always reforming. We should always be reforming what we're doing to make it more like Christ would have it be. Bernard of Clairvaux, he was also a reforming monk. He helped found the Cistercians, which, again, were sort of like a separate branch because the Benedictines were kind of going downhill. These 3 hymns are sung today in many Protestant churches. At least 2 of those are in our hymn book. And he also started over 150 other monasteries. You can see how he was truly a man of the word and his writing and in his hymns that really are today still very important and meaningful to us. When he was reforming the church, there were problems with lots of things like immoral behavior, drunkenness, priests having wives, all this kind of stuff. And he was a zero tolerance man on immoral behavior by people who claim to be following Christ's way. This man is the one who started the Dominicans. They are sort of famous for their preaching. They worked against heresies. He probably is less thought of highly today by Protestants because the Dominicans are associated with, do you know what? The Inquisition. I can see we're not going to finish this today, but I'll do a couple more of these and then stop. Francis of Assisi, again, somebody who came from a wealthy family and walked away from it all, basically divorced himself from his parents and started this order of wandering, begging monks to help the poor. And he certainly did in his own life exemplify what it means to take a vow of poverty. He was also involved in the Fifth Crusade, which had its problems. He did say that I don't know what I was going to say here about him. I sort of forgot.
Dan, are you going to talk about the Crusades later?
Not really, no. Yeah. It wasn't the great event, one of Martin Newell's great events. But you should read the book by Rodney Stark and the Crusades.
Yeah, I would recommend it because I think it's so misunderstood.
It is.
The impetus and the effect and how it came about in the Western world today.
Yep. Albert Magnus was an academic, a professor of theology in Germany and Paris, also became a bishop later. He wrote lots of things in philosophy and theology. Probably he's best known because he taught Thomas Aquinas, who's probably the person who is most influential in Roman Catholic theology, even more than Augustine. I'll just mention a little bit about him in a minute here, but Bonaventure, another Franciscan friar. Notice what he said here. The goal of theology is not truth or knowledge of God, but to love God. If we miss that point, we miss what Christianity is all about. To love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind is the first commandment. It's not to know the truth. And of course, we learn about, we love God more the more we understand and know about him. But we've got to start with our priorities and where we're going with all of this. And like people before him, he emphasized that philosophy was founded on the Christian faith and scripture. Thomas Aquinas, he was an academic his entire life. He tried to bring Aristotle's philosophy into fellowship with Christian theology. He didn't do it by a total compromise of the Christian faith because, for example, Aristotle believed that the creation was eternal. He said, no, God created it. But he did do some things to help support Catholic theology. For example, how he describes the doctrine of transubstantiation, how the bread and the wine become the body and blood of Jesus. And that is done in a, I won't go through the whole thing now, right now, but it's done in a way so that now, after the priest consecrates the elements, then that really is the blood of Christ. So you cannot spill one drop of it or you're guilty of sacrilege. And the same thing true of the bread. In fact, even some parts of the Anglican Church are like that today. When we were in Egypt, we went to a small Anglican church out in the sticks, and the bread had to be consecrated by the bishop in Cairo. Then it was brought out to this guy who was not able to do that because of his rank and went into his freezer and was used, you know, after that. So they were treating the consecration of the bread as almost as seriously as the Catholics do. Thomas Aquinas, though, did contribute a lot to the church. And actually, at the end of his life, when he had almost finished his last major work, he basically gave up and said, it's kind of rubbish. Like, I didn't do a good job. But he did. All these Reformation leaders were influenced by... Actually, I'm over, so maybe I'll start here next time. Okay, thank you for coming. We'll start here next time and finish up this lesson on the monastic movement.